Circle of Mars, the virtue associated with the circle of Mars turns out to be courage, as wisdom was the virtue for the circle of the sun. And unlike the circle of the sun, where Dante was literally surrounded by 24 of the most important sages in Christian history, in the circle of Mars, several cantos are devoted to a kind of dialogue back and forth between Dante and his own ancestor. And really, those are the only two actors on the scene at this point. So what we're going to try and do is to move through the Circle of Mars in this lecture and talk a little bit about why this encounter is so important for the pilgrim on so many different levels.
It's a long and sustained encounter, and it begins, as Dante the poet narrates it, this way. With like affection did Anchises' shade rush forth, if we may trust our greatest muse, when in Elysium he beheld his son. So the introduction to this meeting of ancestor and descendant is, by analogy, the meeting of Virgil's characters, Aeneas, with his father Anchises in the Aeneid Book 6. And so it's an interesting way. We go back to a Virgilian image as a way of Dante beginning his story. And then, in fact, when Cacciaguida speaks, he speaks his first few lines in Latin, very unusual. And also the first three words, O sanguis meus, are, in fact, a quotation from the Aeneid Book 6. O my blood is the way he begins. Now, Dante doesn't know who's talking to him at this time. It takes a while for that to unfold. But here in this very dramatic moment, we have this Virgilian overtone.
A couple of things to say about that. First is that Dante, the poet, is clearly trying to capture that sense of Virgilian pietas, the loyalty between generations that is so manifest in the fact that Aeneas takes a trip to the underworld to see his father. But it's also important that the purpose for that trip, as far as Aeneas is concerned, is to find out an answer to the question, why go on? What's the point of it all? And in some ways, this is a what's the point of it all canto for the pilgrim as well, because here, more than any other place in the entire Commedia, we deal with Dante's mission as a poet, his vocation as a poet, and also we deal head-on with the question of his exile. And all of those are put together, are woven together in this encounter that goes on through several cantos between Dante and his great-great-grandfather.
In Canto 15, Dante picks up his inquiry as to who exactly this is this way. I too, as man, feel this disparity deeply, so only with my heart can I give thanks for your paternal welcome here. A line that's reminiscent of, oddly enough, Inferno 15, where Dante talks about a paternal relationship, as does the person he's talking to. If you recall, that is the sodomite Brunetto Latini. And we talked about how Brunetto uses that language in a kind of artificial way. Here, this is the real thing. This is indeed a relationship between, at least metaphorically, father and son. I beg of you, rich topaz, living gem within the setting of this precious jewel, to satisfy my wish to know your name. And Cacciaguida answers this way. Branch of my tree, the mere expectancy of whose arrival here gave me delight, I was your root. He begins now a process of identifying himself more generally as an ancestor, and then ultimately he will also tell us his name.
And in fact, in this canto, what he does is sort of tell his identity by telling the early history of Florence, pretty much up to the time of his own death. And what he mostly is interested in talking about is the moral virtue that Florence once had in the good old days. The implicit comparison, of course, is between that good time and the factionalism that is essentially splitting the city now. And so he talks about what it was like in the good old days and what those qualities, what those particular virtues were, which were responsible for a city which one would be, as Cacciaguida clearly is, proud to have lived in.
For example, he says, Florence, enclosed within her ancient walls, from which she still hears terse and knowns ring out, once lived in peace, a pure and temperate town. No necklace or tiara did she wear, no lavish gowns or fancy belts that were more striking than the woman they adorned. Dante here recognizes the fact that between Cacciaguida's time, he dies around 1150, and Dante's time, poem set in 1300, Florence has changed radically. Even if you go to Florence today, when you're right in the center of Florence, all the streets are at right angles to one another, because that's the old Roman city, and that's the way Romans laid out things, and that was the ancient wall around Florence. But shortly after the time of Cacciaguida, Florence began to expand rapidly, and as it did, it grew out beyond that set of walls to another set of walls, till still another set that were being built in Dante's own time. And with that rapid building, it also meant that no longer all the streets laid out, but rather, again, even today, when you walk outside the very center core of Florence, the streets start wandering every which way. And I think for Dante, that was both a sign and a symbol of the fact that Florence had become so complex and so chaotic. People had moved into Florence from all kinds of different places, bringing with them various local traditions, ways of doing things, ways of operating. And that complexity was a great problem for Florence in Dante's day. I think that there is a little bit of nostalgia here for the good old days before urban sprawl, if you will, but it's much more than that. He's looking for what made our city united. How can we go back and find a time when the city worked together? Well, it was a time when there was order, literal physical order. Also, it was a time before avarice took over. Women did not wear fancy clothes. Men did not build houses bigger than they needed to live in. So although there is a kind of nostalgic touch to this, it's much more than that. Dante is trying to find and then hopefully reclaim a moment of Florentine unity, order, simplicity.
One way to take a look at it is to see it as a kind of urban pastoral. This is Little House on the Arno. It's within that context that Cacciaguida then goes from Florence to himself. In other words, until he has situated Florence, he can't begin to talk about who he is. That sense of identity through Florence, which of course is particularly interesting in the light of the fact that these are the cantos that are also going to predict Dante's own exile from Florence. But in any case, he talks about himself and says that within your ancient baptistry, a Christian I became, and Cacciaguida. Okay, in other words, he was named at that point. The naming here, I think, in the baptistry, I think is an important thing. Dante obviously plays around with names a great deal throughout the Commedia. This is one where I think it's really worthwhile taking a look at it etymologically speaking. Cacciaguida is the guide, the guida, for the hunt, the caccia, the chase. And it seems to me that in a way, that's kind of the role that he's going to play in Dante's life from here on, in that he is serving as a guide for this hunt that Dante himself is going to embark on. Another way of thinking about his exile is going to be Dante hunted out of Florence. And what Cacciaguida really has to teach Dante is to become the hunter rather than the hunted. And he's a good guy to do this because he tells us, when I was born in Florence, I was baptized. And then he jumps to what was the part of his life which got him here. That is to say, he became a crusader, and when he was off on a crusade, he was killed, and therefore he achieved a kind of martyrdom and came immediately to this point.
I want you to think for a minute about the importance of him being a crusader. First of all, a crusader under whom? He was a member, we're told, of the Second Crusade that was called around the middle of the 12th century. By the way, just sort of file this away for future reference, the main figure that was behind the calling of that crusade was a Cistercian monk named Bernard of Clairvaux. File that away. At any rate, it's the Emperor Conrad who leads this crusade. Here's an emperor of Rome fighting against the enemies of Christendom as they were understood at that time. Here's an emperor doing what an emperor should do. Here's a citizen doing what a citizen should do. This was a time when things worked locally in Florence. This was a time when things worked universally in the time of the empire. And Dante, therefore, is contextualizing Florence once again in the empire. He starts with Florence and goes to empire, while in the discussion of Justinian, he started with empire and made a reference to Florence. So there's this interweaving of the local and the universal.
Canto 15 ends, in fact, with Cacciaguida's martyrdom. And of course, just to sort of state the obvious, that's what guarantees his place in the circle of Mars. Remember, the virtue there is courage, fortitude. So as a crusader, he is on the red planet. And in fact, we are told that when Dante gets there, he sees that the planet is sort of bisected with a kind of crusader's cross. The next canto begins with Dante reflecting on what he has just heard and basically saying it's almost impossible for him not to take pride in what he has heard about his ancestor. He says, "Ah, trivial thing, our pride in noble blood, that you can make men glory in you here on earth where our affections are weak-willed, will never again amaze me, for up there, where appetite is always in the right in heaven, I gloried in my blood." Now, that's a really interesting passage to kind of unpack, because remember, when we were back in Inferno 10, it was all of that pride in ancestry which was really responsible in a very real way for what happens in all of the factionalism in Florence. Is Dante here forgetting the lesson that he has learned up until this time? Has he, you know, has it not made any kind of impression on him when he's saying, boy, am I lucky to have had an ancestor like him? But notice what he says immediately after. He says, "Nobility, a mantle quick to shrink unless we add to it from day to day." And I think what he's saying there is that, again, this image of nobility is a kind of garment that you put on. It doesn't stay on, or it shrinks and is the wrong size, unless your own actions add to it. In other words, what he's saying, very important, is that Cacciaguida's model is something to take pride in only to the extent that it is a spur to one's own similar deeds. And so what it does is kind of raise the question here, which is going to be the question of the rest of this circle. What can I do in my time as a kind of imitation of what my ancestor did in his? And so you see that here, this canto goes, Cacciaguida ended with his death. Now, this canto takes the historical narrative and goes from Cacciaguida's time all the way to Dante's.
Let me suggest you one of the ways that he describes the change that takes place between, again, around 1150 and Dante's time. "Oh, happy wives," he says about the good old days. "Each one of them was sure of her last resting place. None of them yet lay lonely in her bed because of France." It's a very interesting line. Family stayed together, and families lived together, and they died together. Now, France takes its toll on Florence. What does Dante mean by that? Well, first of all, he's talking about greed. He's talking about avarice, because merchants went to France, especially to some of the great fairs in France, to buy goods to sell in Italy as a profit. So wives lost their husband to the fact that business, making a lot of money to build those big houses and buy those fancy clothes, that meant more than staying in Florence with family. But the other thing is, and this refers to the other main change, the change of political factionalism, when the Pope drove out Dante's party, the white Guelphs from Florence, he used French troops. He brought in the relatives of the French monarchy to actually do the military part of kicking out the white Guelphs. So France has led to both the greed and the political factionalism doing its bad stuff, if you will, so that Florence is a very different place. The city is divided, and notice how that trickles all the way down to the family is divided. This stuff all begins at the beginning with individuals and families, and it works its way all the way up, and conversely, what starts with the major policies of the world trickles all the way down. It works both ways.
Not surprisingly, then, when he moves to that history between his own time and the pilgrim's time, one of the things that he zeroes in on are the events that in Florence actually began the struggle between Guelphs and Ghibellines. And he talks very specifically about an event that we have ourselves alluded to several times.
Interestingly enough, at least according to the way the Florentines told the story, there was one particular event that began the struggle between the Guelphs and the Ghibellines. There is a birthday moment. It's one we've referred to before, where a guy had a bride-to-be, and he ditched her for a better offer, and ultimately he was murdered. And that tension, that fighting, began the Guelph-Ghibelline conflict. Well, the guy who jilted his bride and the guy who was later killed was a guy named Juan del Monte. Now, as it turns out in the Guelph-Ghibelline story, he's the founder of the Guelphs. Okay, he's Mr. Guelph. And the guy who did the killing, a member of the Uberti family, Farinata's family, was sort of Mr. Prototype Ghibelline. Which one does Dante single out for condemnation here? He singles out the founder of his own party, Juan del Monte. Dante has to come to grips with the fact that it's not the black Guelphs who are the problem. It's not the Ghibellines who are the problem. It is political factionalism that is the problem. And his own party is equally responsible for the results of that factionalism, as is his opposite party, whether it's a faction of Guelphs in the new days or the Ghibellines in the old days.
We were talking at great length back in Inferno in that canto of factionalism about the factionalism between Farinata and Dante, that it sort of started in the past with Farinata ahead. It moved to the present with Dante getting the knockout punch because his party was in control. And then the kind of sucker punch that Farinata has, we move to the future as we have a prediction of Dante's own exile. Something like the same temporal pattern takes place here, only over a much wider canvas, because it goes for three separate cantos. What we had first was Cacciaguida telling us about the early history of Florence, then bringing it up to the present, and now what you have, sort of prepared the way for by that, is the most sustained and the most important description of the future, that is to say, the future that is Dante's own exile. And Canto 17 of Paradiso starts with a description of that exile and moves to a very thoughtful discussion of what to do about it.
Basically, Dante says to Cacciaguida, you know, for a long time, people have been saying things sort of darkly, sort of obtusely about my future. It hasn't sounded real good. This began, by the way, all the way back in Inferno 6 is the first sort of muted prediction of Dante's exile. I've been collecting all this stuff that people have been saying. Can you tell me what it means? Can you put this together for me? Can you talk about the past? And by the way, they have a little conversation that says, if we can talk about what's going to happen to you in the future, it does not take away your responsibilities. It's not about a kind of fatalism. There is that conversation to precede this. But hey, Cacciaguida, what's going to happen to me?
Well, what's going to happen, of course, is exile, and we know that. But it's very interesting to see the very specific terms of exile as Cacciaguida describes it. And you get a sense for both the causes of it, which I think are interesting, but also the effects on Dante himself. That is to say, we're told about this exile in such a concrete and specific way that we really do get the sense of what personal privation it must have been for Dante. So he talks about the way it's going to happen by saying the following: so it is willed, so it is being planned and shall be done soon by the one who plots it there where daily Christ is up for sale. Well, again, here's our friend Boniface VIII. Where Christ is up for sale, of course, is Rome. This is another way of talking about the sin of simony. And as we've said so many times, it is Boniface's armies that are responsible for Dante's exile. But the problem with all of that, of course, is that when they do it, they also put out a pretty elaborate PR campaign to make sure that they look like the good guys. And so Cacciaguida continues, the public will, as always, blame the party that has been wronged. One of the problems is that in this case, history gets to be written by the winners, right? And of course, implicitly, one of the reasons why Dante gets to write the whole Commedia is to set that right in a way. The comedy can be looked at as history written by one of the great losers, but of course, one of the great losers who turns it into a tremendous victory. Okay, he says, You shall be forced to leave behind those things you love most dearly, and this is the first arrow the bow of your exile will shoot. Again, you're away from home, probably for a good deal of that time from family as well. We don't really know quite as much as we would like about at what point or how often Dante was joined by family members in his exile. But there's reason to believe that, you know, folks had to stay behind to take care of things. And so Dante was probably for part of that time by himself. And then one of the great lines that describes exile: you will know how salty is the taste of others' bread, how hard the road that takes you down and up the stairs of others' homes.
Well, obviously, in a general sense, what he's saying is, you know, you're not going to have any more home cooking. That is to say, you're going to be at the beck and call of others. They're going to house you, they're going to feed you, and you're not going to have control. Things are not going to be familiar. But there's a particular reference here that's interesting. Even to this day, it is true that the Florentines do not put salt in their bread. And in fact, when Florentines go other places, it is still today one of the first things they remark about. How salty is this bread? It's a wonderful symbol because, of course, bread really is the staff of life. Bread has biblical Eucharistic significance, and you're going to be dependent on the bread of others, and you're going to be going up and down somebody else's stairs. What a powerful image of all the things you've taken for granted. Dante's lived in Florence 35 years at this time. All the things that simply have come to be taken for granted. All those things you sort of say, gee whiz, you know, I'm going to Rome on business, but I'll be back in 3 weeks. That's all gone. There is no Florence for him to come back to.
And notice that he's building up here, Cacciaguida. That's bad. That's very bad. But that's not the worst. What will weigh you down the most will be the despicable, senseless company whom you shall have to bear in that sad veil. And all ungracious, all completely mad and vicious, they shall turn on you. Well, we talked a little bit about that again when we were dealing with Farinata, who predicts that the art of coming back after exile is going to be the art that Dante finds very difficult to learn. Now we find another wrinkle, that it's hanging out with all of these sleazy political types who are scheming and wheeling and dealing to try and get back in, which is going to be something that is ultimately going to be a great humiliation to Dante. Who do you have to hang with in order to try and get back? And that's the question that Cacciaguida raises here. And so the answer of all of this, what Dante's going to have to do, it will be to your honor to have become a party of your own. In other words, you got to break out of this factionalism thing once and for all. And part of what Cacciaguida is saying to Dante is obviously an exhortation to do just that.
And you can imagine how this goes. Here are the white Guelphs. Dante's been in power himself in 1300 as one of the priors. And it's easy when you're in power to spout the rhetoric that says, we're doing this for Florence. This action is to make everything good. And then you end up in exile, and your buddies, the same guys, are sitting around saying, we'll do anything to drive those suckers out. We'll do anything. And that's where you discover what factionalism is about. It's not about getting control to do good. It's about getting control to do good for yourself. And Dante has to go through that bitter experience of failed attempts with a bunch of guys to get back into Florence to understand, as Ron just said, that it's not whether you're a white or a black. It's not whether you're a Guelph or a Ghibelline. You've got to break out of the whole mold of this is about me, this is about my party, as Farinata said.
And what Dante's able to place together here is the fact of exile and where he has just been on this journey. Sort of the light bulb goes off and he says, you know, I've been down all the way into the pits of hell and I've climbed the mountain of purgatory. And that means that I've seen things from a perspective that other people don't get to see. If I were to bring that back, all right, then I would be able to kind of make sense out of all of this to the people who are still involved in this fanatical kind of squabbling. And so isn't it a fact then that my job is to take this exile and to turn it into a kind of pilgrimage and therefore to tell others what I have learned? Now he says, that's a really cool thing and I think I'm going to do it, but problems involved in that because folks are not going to like what I have seen and heard and learned down here. And my job is going to be to tell it with all the force of an Old Testament prophet, even if it means getting people very, very angry at me. Well, he has one very great advantage, and that is that by doing this from the position of exile, he's doing it from the point of view of somebody who doesn't have very much to lose. Okay, so the very fact of his being in the position of exile allows him, like the Old Testament prophets, to speak with this extraordinary authority on what he has seen here.
And notice how he turns upside down what Brunetto Latini tried to teach him in Inferno 15, when Brunetto said, "You're right to become famous. Remember my tresor." Listen to what Dante says. "If I am a timid friend to truth, I fear my name may not live with those who will look back at these as the old days." In other words, he now understands if you write for fame, it doesn't last very long. If he's really going to do the right thing and write so that he has a greater presence in the world than just a flash of fame, he's got to tell the truth.
Notice also in that same set of passages, he uses another image about what telling the truth is all going to be about. He says, "I learned things that, were they to be retold, would leave a bitter taste in many mouths." Well, what he's doing then is feeding others salty bread, but he's feeding them salty bread, which is ultimately going to be great nourishment for them. And so the conditions of his own exile, you know, the fact that you can't eat the way you used to, all of those daily things that make it such a painful process turn out to be connected with the larger mission, okay, to go back and feed others. And if it's salty bread, it's certainly going to be good for them. So he sees that part of what he has to do is become a kind of apostle of truth. And in fact, he goes on to sort of get this from Cacciaguida, sort of agreeing with him, saying, the conscience that is dark with shame for his own deeds or for another's may well indeed feel harshness for your words. Now remember, what Cacciaguida is talking about, what words are these? The words are the poem that Dante the Pilgrim here is going to write, namely the Commedia itself. This is the best place in the poem, perhaps, the best place in the entire comedy to see the difference between pilgrim and poet. The pilgrim is learning here what the poet has put into practice in the very poem that we're reading. But then he goes on to say, "Though when your words are taken in at first, they may taste bitter, but once well digested, they will become a vital nutriment." So again, that whole image of feeding and food, which starts out with Dante's own deprivation, now moves to the nourishment of everybody who hears Dante's prophetic voice. And of course, it's also sort of interesting to just piggyback on one thing that Bill said. "I fear my name will not live on with those who will look back on these as the old days." Hey, that's us. I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years have separated Dante's poem from us, but we still read this with profit because he heeded Cacciaguida's advice, because he wrote not for fame. The fame becomes a kind of interesting byproduct of what he's done.
I want to pick up on the notion of here Dante getting a prophetic commission. Very often, as we said way back at the beginning in our introductory lectures, it's easy to see prophets as people that just come in and shake their fingers a lot. But as Dante himself suggests here, there's more to it. If you look at the commission, for example, of Jeremiah, it is to tear down and to build up. The tearing down has to come first. But ultimately, a prophet is one who builds. The tearing down is to clear the way for a new structure. And that's what Dante will do. The words will be bitter, but they will become a vital nutriment. Dante has taken on the crusader mantle from his great-great-great-grandfather and the prophetic mantle all the way back to the Old Testament.
And of course, he learns that he has to be a crusader with the pen rather than with the sword.
Lecture 22, Can a pagan be saved?
We move from the sphere of Mars, up one, to the sphere of Jupiter. And the virtue associated with Jupiter is the virtue of justice. And therefore, we're going to have a sustained discussion about justice. We're going to talk about justice in its sort of earthly political form. We're going to talk about justice in its final, somewhat mysterious divine form. And we always need to remember that we're not talking about two different things. We're talking about two parts of one larger reality. Dante sees a phrase spelled out with lots of little souls making up the parts of the letters. And it's a very important phrase. It's the beginning of the Book of Wisdom in the Old Testament. Love justice, you who rule the earth. And so with that, we will expect that we're going to meet indeed exactly that, a lot of rulers of the earth. But before we do, Dante takes some time out to condemn some of the rulership of his own day. O heaven's army, to whom my mind returns, pray for those souls on earth who are misled by bad example and have gone astray. We learned about bad leadership and its consequences in the middle of the purgatory. Now we're reminded of it again, that one of the consequences is that a lot of people go astray. And he chooses for his example of bad leadership in his own day, oddly enough, popes. It used to be that wars were waged with swords, but now one fights withholding here and there. The bread our fathers love denies to none. This is the misuse of the ecclesiastical power of excommunication for political purposes. And then this canto, canto 18, ends with this phrase. But you will answer, you, the popes, the rulers of the day, I who have my heart set on him who chose to live alone and for a martyr's crown had danced away, know nothing of your fishermen, Peter, or Paul. This is a very lovely image that Dante has created to condemn the popes, because on the major gold coin of the day, manufactured in Florence, was the image of Florence's patron saint, John the Baptist. And so what we're told is the popes love to collect John the Baptist. They love the image of John the Baptist. But it's because it's stamped on coins. And the ones who know John the Baptist, because they're collecting coins, have no time for, oh, you know, Peter and Paul. It's a powerful condemnation of some of the rulership in Dante's own day.
I'm going to hook on to that by saying just a couple of brief things about this. First of all, it seems like sort of an incongruity when you sort of first think about it, that here we are up in paradise and you're talking about injustice rather than justice. In other words, to start this relatively long discussion of the nature of justice, which continues over several cantos in the Circle of Jupiter, with this denunciation. But the important thing to kind of hook it all together is precisely the fact that here you have the vantage point to see what injustice really is, because, of course, you have the maximal alternative in the way in which the souls are configured here in the Circle of Justice. So I think it's important to take a look at it from that point of view. Also, important to see that this idea of excommunication we've seen before, and we've seen it in terms of the various bad Boniface activities that we've been kind of charting pretty carefully in our trip through the Commedia. But here you have another take on it. And it's interesting that here in the Circle of Justice, it's another one of the places where we have another take, another offer on some big issues. And one of the biggest issues that they deal with here, again, obviously related to the question of justice, is that of the salvation of those who are not explicitly Christian, the salvation of pagans, and how does that relate to the idea of a just God?
We have an interesting way that Dante meets these souls. As I said, they spelled out this phrase, which in Latin ends with the letter M, and then the M sort of transmorphs, think about this visually, into an eagle, which is the symbol of empire, so that the souls are little pieces like the tesserae of a mosaic of an eagle. Such things we actually find, for example, in Ravenna.
Which is, of course, where Dante was sitting and writing and composing this. So you have this kind of communal voice speaking to Dante about the nature of justice. And then you have the whole question of the salvation of unbelievers raised in all kinds of interesting ways here. The text puts it in a fairly direct form. Consider that man born along the Indus, where you will not find a soul who speaks or reads or writes of Christ. In other words, people who are not Christian for no fault of their own, who had no opportunity to hear the Christian message, to places where the Christian message hasn't been preached. What happens to those folks? Well, it's interesting to see that the answer is not given in any direct or precise way, but is given indirectly in such a way that it suggests at least the possibility that there's more going on here than humans can know about, and also there's more going on than simply what we had in Inferno 4. That this is one of those places where we learn that Inferno 4 was a first offer rather than a last thought on it. And it seems to me that part of what's going on is that this stuff is saved for paradise because it's stuff that can only be discussed after the foundations have been built through the trip down and then the trip up, because you're in danger of misinterpreting if you take it out of context. The stuff that's said here has to be seen very carefully and has to be seen in terms of nuances that would not have been available at the beginning of the journey.
Even as my notes are too high for your mind to comprehend, so is eternal judgment for mankind. That one of the dangers, I think, that Dante warns us of here is thinking we've got all the answers, thinking that we can figure all of this out, because what we're doing is saying then the divine mind really doesn't exceed the human mind. If I can understand everything that God does and everything that God wills, then God's mind and my mind are at least in the same ballpark. And therefore, and more we're going to find, not less and less, more and more as we move to the very end of the poem, Dante's not going to tell us just that his memory fails, just that his words fail, but it's not in the cards. It's not possible to understand what I experience, that we have to accept mystery, that life is, to use one of my favorite one-liners, not a puzzle to be solved, but contains a series of mysteries that are to be experienced and accepted. And here is one of those places. How can God possibly, we ask, condemn justly somebody who never had to hear the word of God? And yet that seems to be what we're supposed to believe. It seems to be what we learned in Inferno 4, which is, after all, created by God. Hell is created by God along with everything else. So, as Ron said, this is where we talk about it in a much more sophisticated and subtle, but ultimately mysterious way.
First thing seems to repeat what we've already seen. Okay, right after the passage that Bill had just read, it goes on to say, again, the eagle is speaking collectively here, and to this realm none ever rose who had not faith in Christ before or after he was crucified. Okay, the before means that there was a kind of implicit faith on the part of figures from the Old Testament, that their prefiguration of Jesus is sort of responsible for their salvation. Now, the thing that's interesting about this is that a lot of theologians in Dante's time, as well as our own, you know, have commented on what this might mean. And one question that was raised by Thomas Aquinas, among others, was whether this had to be explicit. Could it not be implicit? And so it's presented first as though, well, you know, the rules are pretty tight. But then the next tercet says the following: but then there are all those who cry, Christ, Christ, and at the judgment day will be less close to him than those who know not Christ. In other words, the first thing it's saying is that simply being Christian in any kind of nominal sense gets you nowhere. Well, that we've already known. I mean, hell is full of people who are nominally Christian. All you have to do is go to Inferno 19 and say, hey, popes, proves your point. But the other part of that seems to be that those who are not Christian are going to get a lot closer. Well, again, that seems to suggest the possibility of salvation for them. Such Christians shall the Ethiop condemn the day those two assemblies separate, one rich, the other poor forevermore. Okay, judgment as a kind of separation. In Matthew's gospel, it's presented as the separation of the sheep from the goats. And what it seems to be suggesting here is that there are going to be a lot of Christians who are going to go with the goats, and there are going to be a lot of non-Christians who might be among the sheep. Because, of course, that passage, which is alluded to there, basically says that what you have to do is feed the hungry, give drink to the thirsty, clothe the naked. And the suggestion seems to be that the folks who are better at doing that are the ones who are going to be saved. And then there's a list that follows, which is kind of interesting, of all of the terrible crimes that have been committed by Christians and using the name of Christ in various ways. And I think what's sort of interesting about it is that certainly whatever speculation Dante may want us to engage in, and I think he really does want us to speculate about this, whatever speculation about how non-Christians are saved, what he really wants to do is direct this message against the Christians of his own time who use their religion as a kind of crutch and say that therefore allows me to do anything I want. That the world is divided between those who are officially baptized and those who aren't, and we're the good guys. That's what's emphatically being condemned in this long list that follows.
So, in fact, the Ethiop and the Persian, he says, will judge, and then he lists a series of kings alive in his own day, exactly as Ron suggested, then points out at the end, by the way, there are a couple of kings that don't fall into that general condemnation. But it's really an extraordinary passage where we seem to go back and forth and back and forth on this issue. And it comes to be dramatized more greatly by naming individuals that Dante sees in the next canto. What happens is we sort of focus now on the eye of the eagle. And David is right in the center. David is the pupil. And then we meet five souls, if you will, in the eyebrow of the eagle. And again, make a list of five rulers you expect to find up here, or five people you expect to find here in the sphere of justice, the sphere of Jupiter. I bet it's not these five.
Well, you start out, of course, the chief one is David. Him you would expect. All right. And it's also sort of nifty that he's presented here when we describe him as primarily a poet. He, at the center of the pupil's spark, wrote songs inspired by the Holy Spirit and once conveyed the ark from town to town. Now, first thing that's interesting about that, of course, is that David was thought in the Middle Ages to be the author of the entire book of Psalms. But it also is referring to that very same incident that we saw sculpted in the side of the marble in Purgatorio 10, okay, the sculpture that illustrated the virtue of humility. And interestingly enough, when we move from there to the next figure, we see somebody who was also in that sculptural program.
And that is the other panel taken from classical antiquity was the Roman Emperor Trajan. Now, Trajan lived after the time of Christ. He died in the year 117 A.D. or C.E., but he was not a Christian. That is to say, in fact, we know, I'm not sure whether Dante knew this or not, we know that he actually didn't exactly persecute Christians, but didn't like them very much. There are documents that sort of say to Roman governors, well, deal with them if you have to. We just don't like them very much. They're not very good for the empire. But, you know, just don't go out and slaughter them. It's not the way we do things around here. But here's Trajan up here, very high up in the sphere of Jupiter. An extraordinary choice in many ways.
Next choice, very interesting also, because it's somebody that we have also seen in many places along the way in the Commedia. The next light went to Greece, bearing the laws and me. Remember, it's the eagle that is actually speaking. Well, remember, the flight of the eagle went east when Constantine moved the center of the empire from Rome to Constantinople. Constantine is the one who is being spoken of here. And we find out that despite all of the problems caused by Constantine's actions on earth, he has a very high place here in heaven. And again, it's told explicitly, his good intentions bore the worst of fruits, and now he knows that all the evil sprung from his good action does not harm his soul, though thereby all the world has been destroyed. In other words, even if a lot of destruction comes from this, he had no way of knowing. Again, very important when Bill started out by saying this is a canto which takes you deeper into mystery and says there are limitations to what we can know. This is a way of forcefully embodying that in terms of what happens to our life back on earth. We can't know the effect of what we do. We can only make the best judgments. And that's, you know, the problem of anybody who has to choose, which is, of course, all of us. And so Dante is suggesting through the figure of Constantine something about the mysteriousness of the life that we lead back on earth.
And now the most mysterious of all. Who in your erring world would have believed that Rephaeus of Troy was here, the fifth in this half circle, this eyebrow made of holy lights? And now he knows much more about God's grace than anyone on earth and sees more deeply, even though his eye cannot probe God's depth. Well, who is Rephaeus? Not a household word. You've got to have read even your Aeneid very carefully, because Rephaeus is an extraordinarily minor character in that poem.
He's a walk-on character. He gets two lines in book two. And in fact, the situation is this. Aeneas wakes up to find Troy is in flame, and his first notion is to get a bunch of his troops with him, go out, kill as many Greeks as he possibly can before dying a glorious death in battle. He ultimately doesn't do it, but one of the people, one of that gang, is this guy, Rephaeus. And the line is simply, and here's Rephaeus, judged to be a great man, a great warrior. And then there's a kind of nifty line that Virgil throws in, the gods thought otherwise. And whether that means that, he didn't last very long, which was the case, all of these men are killed in battle, or whether they know something that we don't, it's hard to figure out. But here you have, that's it. He disappears from the stage of history and literature until he's resurrected, literally, by Dante here among the saved. I mean, go figure. A minor character in a poem where the major character, Aeneas, is back in Inferno 4 with the virtuous pagans, and where the creator of that poem is back in Inferno 4 with the virtuous pagans. What did Rephaeus do to get himself saved? Well, I think that Dante is saying, yeah, go figure. That's one of those specific examples that proves that there's more mystery here going on than humans are able to comprehend. But it's also one of these things that says, don't think you know all of the answers because of what you've seen in the Inferno.
Dante, in fact, wants more details about these two pieces of the eyebrow in particular. In the case of Trajan, there's a sort of odd medieval legend that Dante picks up as a way of explaining how a pagan can be in heaven. Because in this legend, several centuries later, Pope Gregory the Great prayed for Trajan, this great emperor, that he wouldn't be lost forever. He actually comes back to life, is baptized, and then gets to go off to heaven. It's an odd medieval story, a medieval legend that Dante uses. But there is no such story for Rephaeus. And so when inquiring, tell me more about Rephaeus, the other soul, by means of grace that wells up from a spring so deep that no man's eye has ever plumbed the bottom of its source, devoted all his love to righteousness and God, and with grace on grace opened his eyes to our redemption, and he saw the light, and he believed in this.
And so the canto concludes by saying, essentially, be slow to judge. And it seems to me that that's a lesson for readers of the Commedia as well. Predestination, the line begins. By that, Dante was not anticipating Calvin. What he meant simply is God's plan for the universe, how deeply hid your roots are from the vision of all those who cannot see the primal cause entire. Again, this way of emphasizing that the gap between human and divine is very great. Rhetorically, Dante has suggested that at the beginning of the Paradiso, by saying, you know, I can't really remember all of what I saw there because it was too great. And now we find on the level of this mystery of salvation, it's too great as well. So he says, you men who live on earth, be slow to judge, for even we who see God face to face still do not know the list of his elect. Okay? This says something, I guess, about what we have to look forward to when we see more of them a little bit later on. But also, it says something about the fact that Dante's own list is not meant to be seen as, you know, exclusive, the whole thing. Or inclusive, I guess, would be right. There are people here that we don't find out about, that Dante doesn't find out about, because these are the ones who manifest themselves to Dante because they're the ones to have the most to tell him. And so what we saw in the case of the souls in the Inferno is also true in the souls here of the blessed.
See, Dante has to deal with this. One of the things Dante could do is to sort of say there are these great sort of inscrutable problems that I don't have a solution for. I could set them aside. There's no requirement that Dante talk about predestination here. The idea, as he understands it, comes out of a passage in Paul's letter to the Romans, chapter 8, God knew his own before ever they were. But what Dante wants to do is indeed engage the great mysteries, not just solve the problems that he can solve. Telling us to engage, telling us what our limitations are, is also part of that prophetic process. Remember, the prophet, first of all, sort of clears away, and then he builds up. Well, if you're going to build up in a right and new way, you've got to let people know what they can't do as well as what they can do. You've got to tell them what's not in the ballpark for them to do as well as what they have to do. So this is a reminder. If you're going to live justly on earth, you should not start making lists and assuming you can figure it out. You should not make the list of criteria. You should not make yourself a checkoff sheet. Say, well, I do this and this and this, I'm fine. And if I don't do this and this and this, I'm not fine. It's a much more complex world because, once again, justice that is divine is reflected in justice on earth among the rulers and even among individuals. It's all part of a continuum. And you can't do justice if you don't know what you cannot know.
We move from justice to the fourth of the so-called cardinal virtues, that of temperance. We've done wisdom, we've done courage or fortitude, we've done justice, and now the final one, temperance. Now, generally, in that scheme, wisdom was seen as the most important, temperance the least. But notice that Dante has kind of reversed this in a way and made temperance the key in a certain way as he, you know, keeps ascending higher and higher. And the way he goes about doing this is very interesting. This turns out to be the place where we find the contemplatives. That is to say, those who have had a kind of direct experience in their own life of God, or at least have lived a life in anticipation of that. And the way he links them to the virtue of temperance is kind of interesting. Thomas Aquinas, who is a figure, of course, that we've had a lot to say about up till now, says that what temperance is, as a virtue, is disciplining the instinctive craving that we all have for pleasure. Okay? And the pleasures of food and drink and sex are the ones that are usually singled out as the most important of these. And so, in the classical way of reading this, that was sort of the necessary first virtue for anything else. You're not going to be wise, you're not going to be brave, and you're not going to be just if you're a glutton, let's say, if you put food or drink ahead of anything else. But Dante goes a little bit farther and says, in fact, temperance is a way of thinking about the discipline of the monastic life, the religious life, and the contemplative life. And so, therefore, it's the virtue that he associates with the great contemplatives, and we get to meet some of them in this canto.
The first one we meet in Paradiso 21 is a very important character named Peter Damian. He was indeed, as Ron suggested, a monk. He was both a hermit and later on lived in a religious community. But in the conversation that Dante has with Peter Damian, who lived in the middle of the 11th century, okay, 250 years before the time the poem is set. Dante's able to do something analogous in terms of the way the church worked back then with what Cacciaguida does in how Florence worked back then. Because what happens is Peter Damian, this great monk, this great self-disciplinarian, this great contemplative, is called away from his monastery. And the story that he tells, although short, is vitally important. There, I was known as Peter Damian, Peter the Sinner, in Our Lady's house that lies along the Adriatic shore. And then he says, what happened was I was there. Little of mortal life remained to me when I was called and forced to wear the hat. By this, he means he became a cardinal, which seems to pass only from bad to worse. Lean and barefooted, Cephas came, and came the mighty vessel of the Holy Spirit, both taking food wherever it was offered. The Pope, Cephas is another name for Peter, and of course the Pope is the vicar of Peter. Cephas, barefoot and slim, a man also of temperance, by the way, this particular Pope was also a monk, this Pope came to me and said, I need you. I need somebody like you. I need somebody who is a man of prayer. I need somebody who is someone who has this discipline to help me reform the church in what we call the Gregorian Reform era. And so he goes to this monk and says, I'm going to give you this hat. I'm going to give you this authority. Now use what you have to help make the church better. That's the way things worked back then. Think about now. Think about Boniface VIII. Think about cardinals' hats being bought and sold as part of the sin of simony. And this serves as a wonderful analog about church reform, the way that Cacciaguida talked about the need for political, radical reform in Florence.
I also want to make a point about the structure in general in Paradiso here. Remember when we were talking about purgatory, we said that the first person that Dante talks with is Casella, this poet, and throughout there are all of these encounters with poets and artists. We talk about them, and we actually meet Casella and Sordello and Statius and all of those poets who were Dante's own predecessors. The way that poets work in the Purgatorio, contemplatives work in Paradiso. That is to say, we meet them at the beginning and we meet them at the end. The first person that we met in the Paradiso was Piccardo Donati, who was that contemplative nun who was sort of snatched away from that particular calling and sort of drawn back into the world. The last person we meet, Bernard of Clairvaux, again, Dante's final guide. And then what we have here is a whole slew of them, and moving from there into the next canto where we see all of these folks who were founders of religious orders. I think what's important in all of these is that they become analogous models for Dante in the same way that the poets were in the Purgatorio. Because what Bill said about Peter Damian is perfect. He's this guy who leads the contemplative life, but the contemplative life helps him to structure the active life and to do reform for the church. Well, of course, in exactly the same way, Dante is moving toward this final contemplative vision that he's going to get at the end of the Paradiso. But the point of it all is not so that he can stay there wrapped in ecstasy. The point of it all is that he can come back and be a reformer.
The person that Dante talks to in the next canto for a long time is the real founder of Western monasticism, St. Benedict, as in Rule of St. Benedict, a 6th century Italian monk. And even today, most Western Catholic monks live under the rule of St. Benedict, and they live cloistered, and they are regarded as contemplatives, and they get together many times a day to pray. And one of the ways that sometimes people see them today is, well, they're doing it all for themselves. What do they have to do with the world? What's interesting is that with this meeting of Benedict, Dante starts out in the story of Benedict not talking about how all the monks are sort of wrapped in ecstasy, but rather when Benedict founded his monastery at Monte Cassino, there were a lot of pagans in the area. This was a time when Italy was not fully Christianized. And so what he describes is monks as missionaries. I, Benedict says, was the first to carry up to them the name of him who brought down to the earth that truth which gives mankind the strength to rise. What makes Benedict a great missionary? What makes monks great missionaries? It is, of course, that they are rooted in, prayer and discipline. How many times today or then do people say, what I want to do is I want to go fix the world. I want to take care of the world. I want to make it better. What Dante wants to suggest to us that is, although a good ambition, it's not possible if you don't, in a sense, fix yourself, if you aren't correctly rooted, correctly disciplined, correctly oriented, then even if you set out perhaps to save the world, you will in some ways ultimately fail in doing that.
Well, we've seen Dante meeting people of great virtue in the last four spheres of Paradiso. We'll look at Dante himself examined in virtues in the next lecture.
Lecture 23, Faith, Hope, Love, and the Mystic Empyrean.
Remember at the end of the last lecture, we said that it was Dante's turn to be examined in the virtues of faith, hope, and love. This, of course, is a way of reminding us of how we started our journey. The first three spheres that we encountered, the Moon, Mercury, Venus, contain souls who were lacking in those particular virtues. Then we moved to the sphere of the Sun and outside of the shadow cast by the Sun, so that the souls that we met there were